masters of the apocalypse, searching for lost tales in eclipse. Why your dreams are shattered lines, sci-fi whispers lost to time. Welcome, constant listener. We are the Podcasters of the Apocalypse, and this is My Internet Has Stopped Working, episode 4 or 5. I don't remember.
Episode five.
And today we're going to talk about a shockingly timely book called The Iron Heel.
Too timely.
Written in 1907 by a very famous dude called Jack London. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to hand it over to, I won't give her a name yet.
Play the pop tones.
We're going to introduce ourselves and then do our first encounter. So Britt Everharmon, if you don't recognize that name, read the book.
You'll know it soon.
So I helped pick this book. So we were discussing the possibility of reading 1984 by Orwell. And we had an argument about, you know, it's one of the most famous sci-fi novels of all time. So obviously it can't count as a lesser known novel. But then we argued, well, most people quote it or know about it, but never have actually read it. So, well, it's also the most banned book of all time. Side note.
I did not know mm-hmm. that.
So we didn't think that still met the criteria. So I said, what about finding a dystopian book about oligarchies, you know, tongue in cheek?
Exist?
Does yeah. that exist? And we found this book and it was disturbingly on point for my existence right now in this current administration.
So your first encounter with it was just then.
Traumatic, yeah. It was just then, and I Googled sci-fi, like classic sci-fi dystopian oligarchy novels, and boom, there it was. And I was like, I didn't even know Jack London wrote this genre. So
Sci-fi.
Yeah, and I think it's always amazing because, you know, it's written in 1908,
you
right?
You should introduce yourself.
By the way, I'm new to the podcast. Yay. My name is Claire Boots the House Down Lapolowin. And, you know, the first time what I really wanted to say, because we're going to all fix this in post, was that I think it's so fascinating that London wrote this, 1908? So it's over 100 years old, and how current many of the themes of this novel still feel as we're grappling with a lot of things we're seeing right here in the U.S. So my first experience with the work was to prepare for this podcast, which was really exciting. And it's also just been really timely in conversations I've been having with people. I feel like I've been recommending this book to a lot of people as I've been reading it, just because I feel like there's a lot of really important themes that people are really trying to grapple with. What can I be doing right now in this point of period of history that I live in? So I feel like for me, it kind of helped give me some ideas that I wanted to share with other people and give me language to really describe some of the things I was seeing as well, which can be really helpful.
Yeah. Do you want to read the book that's going to send you to therapy? Read this book.
Yeah. NPR Natalie.
My name is Natalie the Red Virgin.
She was really my favorite character. She was more like a character in passing, but I liked the way that they talked about her.
She's a good character.
I like every single other book that has been featured on this podcast. I was told to read it by my boss. So
great first contact.
I actually really didn't know. I think I was somewhere else in my brain when we were talking about what book we should read. And so I remember you saying 1984, and I was like, great. That sounds good. But I didn't really, like, when you said, oh, The Iron Heel, I was just like, I don't know what that's about. And so
now you do.
The foreword was very jarring. It, like, just
lays into you.
You want to be in 1908 or 2025? Sorry, was that really loud?
That mic was hot.
The thunder
clap. just, you know, like, really. Wait, when was this book written?
1908.
No. It was like that was what I was like.
Yeah.
It was written. It was depicting 1912 to 1932.
Right.
Yeah.
But then also, you know, we'll get into this more, but just like remembering that the book isn't even from the point of view of today, like a historian reading it, like in 2025, but rather 700 years from now.
Yeah.
And the fact that he even like mentions the early 2000s in the book was like,
I know, anyway. That was disturbing. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. I'm Justin Olamarkey.
Oligarchomarchy?
Oligarchomarchy.
Oligarchomarchy.
Maki the oligarchy. Yeah, same as everybody. I knew Jack London from other works called mm-hmm. Wild White Fang, but had not even heard of this. So I thought it was really interesting in a traumatic sort of way. I know mm-hmm. Britt Everharman mentioned that it gave her nightmares. I didn't have specific nightmares, but this was a really hard read. This was on point, and you look at the devolution of our current systems, and you think, wow, dude really, really nailed it hard.
And, like, with stunning accuracy mm-hmm. from 1990.
Yeah. I think he probably would be happy to miss this.
He would be thrilled to not mm-hmm. be here right now, yeah. although it sounds like it was pretty shitty back in the
yeah, and the on that note.
Please go.
Written in 1907 but published in 1908, The Iron Heel is a dystopian political sci-fi novel, written as though it is a manuscript found hundreds of years after it was written by the wife and socialite turned social activist Avis Everhard, the wife of a deceased social activist, which is Ernest Everhard, who was murdered by the Iron Heel. The novel is formatted as though it is a historical text with footnotes by a scholar from the year 2600. So that's about 600 to 700 years after the time period depicted in the document, which is 1912 to 1932, which is technically 5 years into the future of when Jack London was writing the book. So it was future for him, but not the distant future. So this was a free online version of the book because it's in the public domain. That's what I read. Did anyone else read any other versions?
Project Gutenberg.
That's mm-hmm. the one I read as well.
I did an audiobook version that I found on
Maybe play a little
Spotify.
Excerpt of the voice. I like listening to the getting a voice sample of your audiobook person.
Sometimes it'll tell you who.
Was the narrator a woman?
James Hamill. No, it was a man, which I enjoyed because it was like the historian is a man. And so I was like, the historian is reading me the manuscript.
Okay,
right?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. His voice is very nice. Let me turn it down to normal speed.
Yeah, this should be noted that Natalie listens to all her audiobooks at 1.25 speed, so it's kind of like what, the chipmunks.
Yeah. Okay, so here's a bit of the introduction.
Recording by Matt Saw. The Iron Heel by Jack London.
This is also on YouTube, forward. And I did supplement my reading with at some first. Of this as well.
Yeah.
He has a very mesmerizing voice.
He does. It was the only light in the very darkness of the last few weeks.
A British
with his
accent.
Voice amidst me listening to a science fiction book while simultaneously reading what is not science fiction but the exact same thing.
And
on
living
the news.
A dystopia.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
First of all, it was October, a rare month for boys, full of cold winds. Long nights, dark promises. Days get short, the shadows lengthen. The wind mourns in such a way you want to run forever through the fields.
So, player attributes. Who wrote it and why? So, Jack London was born in 1876 and died at 40. Whew. In 1916. Yeah, short life.
He depressed himself.
Yeah, he did. An American novelist and short story writer from San Francisco. London lived in poverty and was abandoned by his biological father and raised by his spiritualist mother and the stepfather whose name he adopted. So he experienced depression-era conditions, was jailed for vagrancy, which is a thing that we don't call it being jailed for vagrancy now, but we do the same shit in the United States, and in 1894 became a militant socialist. His words, not mine. Not unlike his character, Ernest. So London's writing was influenced by his reading of Darwin, Marx, and Nietzsche. In his short life, he completed 50 books in 17 years.
Oh, working smart.
Right? So based upon the time period when London was writing and his militant social activism, it can be concluded pretty confidently that the economic happenings of the time period influenced his writing, right?
I think it makes sense.
In reading about his life, his expenses typically exceeded his income, and he spent most of his life under financial strain, varying levels of poverty until the end of his life. In 1907, the year he wrote this book, the U.S. experienced something called the Panic of 1907, also called the Knickerbocker Crisis, which was a global financial crisis caused by a series of poor banking decisions. This may sound vaguely familiar. This event resulted in a monetary reform movement that led to the what we now know as the Federal Reserve System. So this financial crisis is considered to be second only to the Great Depression in severity and similar to the one I went through, the 2007 to 2009 financial crisis in the U.S.
Which is funny that it's exactly 100 years later.
Right? Yeah, and I graduated jobless from college with an ass load of student debt in 2009. So this is, I'm reading this and I'm like, wow. You know, and especially in a post-COVID world, financial crises, et cetera, this is just something that's all too familiar, which is why it was such a disturbing book to read. You know, I have a bunch of quotes to read down the road, but there was one paragraph I wanted to read. There was a historian writing about the pertinence of Jack London's life related to his writing in this book, and this is a quote. "Never in the history of the world was society in so terrific flux as it is right now," Jack London wrote in The Iron Heel, his 1908 dystopian novel in which a corporate oligarchy comes to rule the United States. He wrote, "The swift changes in our industrial system are causing equally swift changes in our religious, political, and social structures. An unseen and fearful revolution is taking place in the fiber and structure of society. One can only dimly feel these things, but they are in the air now, today." And now today. Whew. Getcha.
Almost chilling, honestly. I know. To see so many similarities.
I know. I mentioned the main point of the book is depicting a specific era in militant social revolution. And it is widely extensive. It goes over about, it's just a long period, until the new era in which the historian is annotating this text well into the future. And the structure is kind of a documentary style format.
Hello, Hal, do you read me? Do you read me, Hal?
Affirmative, Dave. I read you.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Heroes and villains.
Okay. So we are using Google Notebook LM, and we...
This is not an endorsement.
This is not an endorsement, but we did feed the entire book into the AI because it's in the public domain, and we were able to query it and get things like a list of heroes and villains. So I see you have it up. Claire, you want to give us a few?
Yeah, happy to kind of share a little bit about what... I think it's also really fascinating to see what AI kind of pulls out as hero and villains and just kind of seeing how people are descripted in text, right? Like what keywords is this system itself going to be pulling out to really identify people and code people?
I'm curious to see if my list matches AI.
Specifically Justin's AI, right? Like,
ooh, yes, ooh. So true. How much our individual preferences right. can really shape that as yeah. well. Really, really great point. So I'll share a little bit here about what we have pulled out from this text using Google Notebook, and then happy to kind of hear more from other people's individual perspectives. But looking at our heroes list, you know, I think it makes sense that we start with Ernest Everhard. He's definitely the central figure, who's a socialist leader and an intellectual.
And he has big arms.
Oh, that is half of what my notes are about.
His description is so bizarre.
There are so many notes about how big and burly his arms are, how much Avis loves being in them. That's in my like cringy section we'll get to later because there's just a lot of mentions of it. But all of this aside,
I like my men brainy and buff.
He's passionately advocating for the rights of the working class and predicts the rise of the oligarchy. He organizes and inspires resistance against opposition and is devoted to the cause of the revolution. So really the central figure we see in the novel, educating Avis as she's kind of, I feel like we're going on the journey with her of like understanding, oh, this is what the world is like. And I've never experienced.
While there's a lot of physical description of his arms, he's an intellectual hero. Like, I think that is the main point that that doesn't capture, is that he is dancing rings around the oligarchs and the religious figures of the time, and every leader he can get his little mind on, he is spinning them into submission with his words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, till he dies.
Yeah, pressing on them and asking hard questions for sure. Like, I really love the Philomath scene where he's like in front of everybody on the stage, really pressing these people for answers to his questions, and they really don't have a lot of great responses for him.
They're like fallacy. He's like.
Oh, screw you.
What? Name the fallacy. And they're like, fallacy. He's like, okay.
Insubordination.
Yeah. Right. Which, you know, I think it's funny. We're seeing very similar trends in our current.
We could use one of those. Right. Not a fallacy, but somebody who can actually put people in their place and tell them what to do and not do.
But then people are just yelling, fake news. Yep. Un-American. Well, it's the same shit.
And using logic, too, because I think that's a huge part. He's really able to logically pin into place how these things are happening in a very clear and ordered way that you can't switch these facts on top of themselves because it's very clear and direct.
And not only that, but he's like, you know, sometimes I think coming from like a philosophical or academic mind, you can get drawn into the trap of like, but this isn't what's actually going to happen, right? Like, you know, an economist can say this is how people should think, but that's not what's going to happen. And I think what he does is he's very realistic about these facts. Mm-hmm. Like, he has no, or at least it seemed to me, he didn't have a delusion that he would be alive by the time this was resolved.
Yeah,
he is very aware of the fact that this is the beginning of a very, very long road. So that he will only be a small.
This kind of intellectual hero, though, is one area where I feel like London missed it and Orwell got it. Because in Orwell, you have the whole idea of doublethink and people's ability to fool themselves, to fake themselves. Mm. No matter what you logically argue, I don't care because my reality isn't your reality.
Right.
It's tough. And I think he missed that. He did not predict that accurately, but Orwell certainly did.
Mm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Another argument in favor of 1984 from Justin.
Well, 1984 had the benefit of coming after.
It did, yes.
Well, I mean, do you think he kind of hits it with how the oligarchy, like how they talk about the oligarchy is doing what they think is right, even though
it's wrong. And I pulled that
wrong.
Wrong. Because they're deluding themselves into believing I'm doing right, which is could be said for a lot of people who voted for the current president of the United States. I read in a Wall Street Journal article 2 days ago that they believe that this economic strain that we are now in is worth it in the long run. No, it's not. This doesn't have to happen.
Yeah.
So I think he like maybe he just starts to get there.
Yeah, he shows us the possibility that you can intellectually beat the bad people into remission. Submission.
Or maybe it's like a planted seed that Orwell takes then and grows in 1984, exactly. Like we see a lot more.
It's the natural extension.
Yeah, what I would call like the messaging, the outward messaging of how these things are being categorized.
One thing just pulling off from that. One thing I was thinking about is how many dystopian novel authors read this and were like, I'm going to be the future in 700 years. Because from the very beginning, I was like, are we now in the Hunger Games?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, I was like, this is what happened before the Hunger Games, and now we're in the Hunger Games.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because the historian's talking about all these, like, magnificent cities and stuff. I was like, wait, where are we now? Mm-hmm. But then also with George Orwell, like, even though this is a relatively unknown book, like how many authors were
Orwell absolutely knew it and based his
report
on it. So, all right, more heroes.
Oh, yes.
Sorry.
No.
I can take, I will go on to our next person. Yeah. I mean, clearly it makes sense that we mention Avis Everhard. She's the narrator and Ernest's wife. She evolves from a member of the privileged class to a dedicated revolutionary. And really, I feel like the novel itself is kind of like cataloging her journey through that process of really coming from that privileged place, recognizing that, and then ultimately deciding to kind of change her course of action. She also documents all the events and offers personal insights into the struggle against the Einheil. And I would say also insights into Ernest himself as well. Like, I feel like we get a little bit more understanding of who he is behind closed doors when they're together that we wouldn't get unless we were hearing the story from her perspective.
Bishop Morehouse.
Yeah, somehow didn't make the list from Google Notebook.
Oh, I wasn't even looking. See, Bishop Morehouse was my... I mean, obviously, Ernest, yes. Bishop Morehouse, ultimate hero.
Yeah, my favorite character. But
I think above Ernest, which, like, I think London did really well of showing, like, you can have this super intellectual person who still, like, they're so dedicated to the cause, are missing what's happening right now, which is what...
people who are suffering.
Right. Mm-hmm. Bishop Morehouse is like, yeah, I'm dedicated, but I'm, like... It matters what I do, but what I do is going to have an impact on people's actual everyday life now.
Yeah, he sold everything, secretly sold everything so that he could feed the poor, but then still got
screwed.
Screwed.
Yeah. But I think...
But he did it over and over and over. He kept doing it.
But I think, like, when we talk about, like, subtle acts of resistance, he's like, oh,
I know.
You know, pedestal. This is the guy that we should all look up to.
Well, I think it's, like, in some ways what, like, you would hope everyone aspires to, right? Like, if you hear about injustice and the ways that you're maybe perpetuating it in the world, that you would take action to change the impact of those actions. In some ways, I feel like he acts as, like, this spirit of, like, how we would hope anyone would act upon hearing this information. That, you know, he goes to extreme ends to try to, like... In some ways, I feel like atone for, like, the past, right?
The church.
He's a Jesus figure. He's giving up everything in his life. Not that Avis or Ernest isn't also, but the bishop also surely is.
It's like once he has this knowledge, you know, he's filled, I think, with, like, remorse and guilt as well as action, right? And so, you know, I kind of see him as this perpetual figure that maybe we all aspire to, like, one day be in that place where, yeah, we give away our possessions and we give to the poor and, like, we're, you know, not ideally arrested or institutionalized, but we're still doing it in the face of what we know is right and just. I think that's something that we, quote unquote, everyone aspires to be in that way.
I think one of the key things about Ernest that was an impediment to him being the ultimate hero in this was that he fell in love with Avis. And he talked about this as, you know, you have to be able to sacrifice everything and not have anything on earth that's keeping you from the ultimate ultimate connection. And the bishop, his whole life was in service to people. Now, he realized that initially he was just serving the Iron Heel. He was serving money and possessions and not actually helping the poor. So then he got rid of everything and actually started really doing what he had always thought he was doing. But he didn't have the impediment of children or a spouse. He was just taking care of his flock.
And free to do that.
And free to do so. Because him being murdered, ending up in a wave of humanity, which was devastating, that scene at the end, is the one that gave me nightmares. Yeah. He was able to make that ultimate sacrifice, knowing that technically no individual would be traumatized by his death. Which, just like Jesus.
Similar character, Avis's father, whose name I'm not remembering because Notebook didn't pull it out.
Oh, yes.
So this is definitely not an endorsement of Google Notebook. Is it missing half of the
characters? John Cunningham.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he's a good character, but I think he's the type of academic who's deluding himself because he really believes, unlike Ernest, that this will be overcome in his lifetime. Mm-hmm. So, like, when Ernest tells him to take the retirement and he's like, I don't need to do that, it's fine. Ernest is like, mm-hmm. effing idiot. You're an idiot.
Yeah.
You're an idiot. Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, with blissful abandon, he dives into the life of a proletariat worker.
Like he's playing dress up.
Yes. That's, yeah.
I have my costume.
It gave me Peace Corps ick. Like, you know, when people go to a country to do service for other people, it's like they're playing dress up in another person's culture, right? Mm-hmm. Where I felt like he was trying, maybe in some ways, to understand the plight of people and what was happening. But ultimately, sometimes you're like, the place of privilege that you do have doesn't allow you to really enmesh yourself in those communities in a way that you can really gain from the experience. Like, I felt like he was trying, but he always, in some ways, I felt like had this get out of jail free card where he could go back into privilege and
even though he lost all his privilege.
Yeah.
And wash his hands, you know.
But even when, like, I feel like Avis doesn't get to the depths of having no privilege until she's in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because throughout the whole book, every single chapter, she's learning, oh, I'm still privileged.
Yes.
Oh, I'm still privileged. Because when they go into the ghetto of San Francisco, she's like, and then Bishop Morehouse took me down this road that I didn't even know existed. I thought I was in the ghetto, but it turns out this is the ghetto. The ghetto of the ghetto.
Yeah.
And she's just like blown away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because all of her basic needs are being met and more.
Mm-hmm. And then like after when she goes into hiding after being released from prison, she still is in
privilege. She's in some sort of paradise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Like it's like, until she's in that stable shop in Chicago, laying under blankets, and she's like, what do I do?
World coming to?
There's dead people.
I'm all by myself.
I see dead people
everywhere. Oh my God. Yeah. I think her father just saw this as a lab experiment. I think every time he would talk, I just pictured him, you know, changing the variables in his little human lab experiment. And I think that it wasn't malicious, but he was a caricature of a lot of people's social activism. You know, I think that Jack London did a good job of showing us the different types of people who engage with activism and who they are. Mm-hmm. And maybe this is one of the reasons why these books are difficult to read, because you're like, who am I?
Yes.
Who am I going to be in this kind of situation? Am I going to be the derpy, like, lab scientist guy who from a place of privilege is like, I'm going to dress up like the natives, you know, or am I going to be the person that's down in the dirt giving everything I have till my last breath to save the people who are in need?
Or the virgin assassin,
which at this point I think is the best possible option. Okay.
So shall we talk about her?
Oh, yeah.
We're not getting anywhere with the Google Notebook heroes.
For real.
I mean, she's just... Yeah,
she's an assassin.
Tell us what you think.
I think she's a hero villain duel. Because
in the future they talk about her. She is a heroic figure in the future.
Yeah, but I think, like, at least what I got from her was like, you know, Avis is like, oh well, that's cool, I guess, that she, you know, didn't care enough about any human person that she could just go around killing a bunch of oligarchs and you know, like, she just didn't care. And
on purpose, she avoided relationships.
Right,
yeah.
Right. I think, like, Avis is like, oh, that's, like, if Ernest didn't have me, maybe that's how he would be. But I think, you know, she's just one cog in the wheel of, like, she's like, maybe I can't. I'm not Ernest. I don't have an intellectual mind, but I can get men into bed and slit their throats. So,
we all have our skills.
And it's strange you identify with that. It's okay.
one of my favorite
pastimes.
No, one of my favorite scary movies. I can't remember what it's called, but the lover of this husband stabs him with a letter opener. Or ice pick, I can't remember. Ice pick or lead. Anyway.
Pen?
I like those kind of scary women being scary.
Oh, yeah. Love a scary woman. I'll take it.
Mm-hmm. Probably because I'd never be able to do that.
Yeah. Well, I think, like, it's nice to see, right, like, I think women taking power, right, mm-hmm. you know, into their own hands.
Yeah.
I think that's something that maybe resonates with you.
So. Yeah.
And a lot of the powerful characters in this book were men. You know, even though Avis was writing this text, she was primarily writing about male participants in a revolution. So it was nice to see a badass, terrifying female character. Yeah.
I also wanted to bring this up because it didn't, when I was picturing all the characters in my mind, it was actually quite a diverse set of people. And I didn't realize until they're on the train to Chicago that all of these people are white. And I was like, oh, this adds another level.
That's in my WTF moment. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I totally missed that.
No, it's like one line where they're sitting on the train. And I can't remember.
The servant people on the train.
The servant people.
And they make a comment.
And they make a comment.
Oh, I do remember that.
And she goes, I think it's something like, the Negro is just as scared as I am. Mm-hmm. No, duh. They're a human being, but it's like they're all grouped into what's that group of people?
The proletariat.
My list just went away. Slave class.
The abysmals or something.
The abysmals. Yeah.
People of the abyss.
People of the abyss. Yep. Yes. That's it. Yeah, they're just automatically in there, and so I was like. That was
another Avis like privilege moment, right? Where we're like, there's still levels that we haven't uncovered. I think
black people don't even matter in this.
Yeah, yeah. Like within the cast, like basically, black people are the untouchables.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If we're relating to a caste system, that
they're not even there. They're right.
No.
Wallpaper.
They're just a faceless entity, a sea of humanity.
Of an environment.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's good.
So, that was just like a jarring moment for me because I had realized that I had given certain characters races in my mind and didn't realize that actually all of them were white. And I was like, oh, okay.
Yep. Whoops.
Sorry, Jack London.
Yeah.
Jack London's like, aren't main characters all white? It's the early 1900s.
And I think maybe because I was relating it so much to today, I was like, if this book was being written about today, they wouldn't all be white characters. Mm-hmm. Mm.
But a lot of, in the last 10 years, a lot of sci-fi fantasy depictions are very diverse. Mm-hmm. And, 20 years ago, that was not the case.
Yeah.
Right.
There's one like Stephen King's Running Man, which I know we haven't done it. That's a sci-fi one. It's about a guy, presumably a white guy on the run, but much of the network of people he ends up helping him are black people. Hmm. And I know Stephen King is often criticized as being racist, but...
But he's actually saying that white men are helpless, so...
Even Stephen King.
I'll take it.
Yeah. Okay, we have at least one or two villains, or at least one big class of villain.
Yeah. And I was having issues because I was like, well, isn't the Iron Heel, the whole point is that it's a massive, uncountable entity. There's no single villain. But obviously there's like Iron Heel, the banks, Wall Street, the treasury, the railroads, the wealthy, all the privileged capitalists.
They're all the oligarchy.
The upper middle class. They're all the oligarchy. So just like the boogeyman.
I think we do a disservice to ourselves by naming any of them. We just go with the oligarchies.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I think is really interesting about the notes that are in here on the notebook, it says, right at the bottom we have this, hero and villains, but it says, it's important to note the concept of hero and villain is often determined by the class allegiance. So when the working class is viewing those who fight for their rights as heroes, while the oligarchy sees them as villains. So it's really about who's a hero for which.
Good job, AI.
Things, and ethical delusions. It touches on that, too. The strength of the oligarchy lies in its satisfied conception of its own righteousness. So just some kind of interesting things when we're thinking about like labeling people heroes and villains. It's all kind of subjective in some ways, too.
Ooh, it makes me think about how the movement, the militant socialist movement, Avis talked about this, I believe, about how sometimes they were more scary than the Iron Heel to people if they were traitors.
Mm. Yes.
That traitor piece, you know, if there was a traitor in the midst when they found, they ruthlessly brutalized them and had held them up as examples of what would happen. So in some cases, she was recognizing that in fighting a villainous entity, you can often become a villain, which was kind of gives me goosebumps.
Yeah.
One group that I was, you know, I don't necessarily think they're like a villain in from like a novel perspective, but like definitely in Ernest's mind are the Machine Breakers. Mm-hmm. They're the villains to.
They do end up on the list.
Like to progress of overcoming the right.
Right.
They unintentionally feed back into the growth of the oligarchy, which when they're described multiple times, I was like, this sounds like a lot of people who, again, voted for their current administration. I want to go back to when this wasn't happening. Mm-hmm. So let's go back, not realizing that when you do that, you actually forward something that you don't want in your heart, mm-hmm. but don't understand that mm-hmm. that's what you're doing. Because you're like, no, if I just say let's go back, we'll just go back. And that's not true. Right. You can never go back. You will always go forward.
Yeah. And I guess just for the listeners, so much of this book is about the evolution and growth of society. Mm-hmm. So much of it depends on the capitalist system and the ways in which the capitalist system grows and feeds back on itself and shortages and overages and things. And
the throwing and the extra product into the ocean. I was like, whoa, Jack London, you're like way, way ahead of your
miles
time.
Ahead.
Right.
Yeah. And the thing Natalie's talking about is the way in which a certain group of people determine that the best way to stop it is to stop the advance of that. But it will actually just not work out because the real advance is socialism for Jack.
Yeah. For this book.
Do we want to transition from...
To beam me up, Scotty?
Yes, let's science it up.
Yeah, well, I told the captain I'd have this analysis done in an hour.
How long would it really take? An hour? Oh, you didn't tell him how long it would really take, did you?
Well, of course I did.
Oh, laddie, you've got a lot to learn if you want people to think of you as a miracle worker.
Science time. Since this is a science fiction podcast, we try and talk about some science. Only one piece of science in here that I could pull out, and that was the weird reference to plastic surgery.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
yes.
Towards the end, amongst the revolutionists were many surgeons, and in vivisection, they attained marvelous proficiency. In Avis Everhard's words, they could literally make a man over. To them, the elimination of scars and disfigurements was a trivial detail. They changed the features with such microscopic care that no traces were left of their handiwork. The nose was a favorite organ to work upon. Skin grafting and hair transplanting were amongst their commonest devices. The changes in expression they accomplished were wizard-like. Eyes and eyebrows, lips, mouths, ears were radically altered. By cunning operations on tongue, throat, larynx, and nasal cavities, a man's whole enunciation and manner of speech could be changed. Desperate times give need for desperate remedies, and
desperate
the surgeons
housewives.
Of the revolution rose to the need.
I just like desperate, and then I'm desperate housewives that just all the plastic surgery. Mm-hmm. Like, wow.
Well, I was thinking Logan's Run, which I don't know if anybody's seen.
Uh-uh.
Logan's Run, fantastic 70s movie. Like, same era as Soylent Green. Basically, when you reach 21, you are killed. So the society is overpopulated. They all kind of live in a dome, and there's runners who are people who are fleeing when they turn 21, and there's a incredible scene with lasers and surgery where the plastic surgery goes wrong because one of the runners wants to get surgery via this machine. I think I haven't seen it in a while. They remember that he's, or they figure out that he's a runner, or they try and kill him and the machines go bad and start cutting up people.
Oh.
So, yeah. But that was most of the science. Anybody have any other specific science?
I think the other science was only brought up by the historian. Mm-hmm. Who would then be like, because he talked about, we don't need this plastic surgery anymore in the future, but then also talks about like the differences of, in some of the notes when they're like, you know, talking about how the trains are running or how, you know, a car gets from one place to another. He references like that's not how it is anymore, but it's very vague.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no specific science.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So Other than social sciences.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then I dug into social science, and so much of this is based on real things or real events that happened around the time he was writing. So we've got a great railroad strike in 1877. That was in the U.S. Was violent clashes between railroad workers and government forces. There was the Haymarket Affair in 1886. Mm-hmm. Labor protest in Chicago that turned violent when a bomb was thrown at police, leading to a crackdown on anarchists and labor activists. It sounds very much like that made it into the book.
Mm-hmm.
The Homestead Strike of 1892, which was a battle between steel workers and private security forces at Carnegie Steel. There was a Pullman strike in 1894, a national railroad strike that was crushed by federal troops, much like the repression of labor in the Iron Heel. And, of course, it presages the Marxist Revolution. The Socialist Party of America was founded in 1901, and it was very prominent during London's time. Press and media, these were traumatic. The novel describes the oligarchy controlling the media to suppress dissenting voices, a theme that you were actually seeing in real time. So you had investigative journalists, Upton Sinclair, Ida Tarbell, who investigated Rockefeller Standard Oil, Lincoln Steffers, who wrote something called The Shame of the Cities. They were actively exposing government corruption. And then the press and the capitalists, there seemed to have been some kind of real crackdowns on media at those times. Rise of fascism is very handily predicted in here. The oligarchs really are right there, even though this is pre-fascist. Chicago Commune is inspired by the Paris Commune of 1871, which is a socialist uprising which workers briefly controlled Paris before being brutally suppressed. Failed socialist revolutions, real struggles, revolutionary movements, including Russian Revolution, which is 1905 and 1917.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, political corruption and voter suppression, all common at this time. Anti-socialist repression, the Pinkerton Detective Agency, hired to break strikes and attack union workers. There were state militias and federal troops that were used to suppress labor uprisings. Espionage and Sedition Acts of 1917 and 1918, passed after London's death, reflected the kinds of legal repression he predicted against socialist labor movements. And then, of course, this influenced a bunch of dystopian novels as well, which we'll talk about, I think, in a little bit. Mm. So just a ton of things that led up to him writing this and that he magically almost predicted with shocking accuracy.
Yikes.
Which, yeah, I have a gotcha moment that I'll bring up that relates to that. But
and yeah, I didn't have, other than I think it was overwhelming, you know, reading the book and feeling a lot of connection to what was happening, but doing some looking up and realizing how many things happening in the book written by London had preceded him or was happening or would soon happen. Right. So, you know, it does feel very cyclical. It feels like we're coming back around to a very dark time for the people, which the Iron Heel is squishing. You know, it's disturbing. It's this book really was depressed me.
It got in the mind.
It did. Yeah. And it stuck in the mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My wife is Adelina Mabel Warren Hagstrom.
Well, if you're gonna make a wish, wish for some damn money, will you?
All of the next section that we're going to venture to soon is the word processor of the gods. So identifying our favorite dramatic and well-written passages, all of mine are disturbing.
Oh, I love that.
It's like there were no beautiful, uplifting passages. They were beautiful in the way they were written, but just disturbing as hell.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Someone else can go first. I'm not ready.
I would love to go. My favorite. This one was from the Philomaths because for some reason I was so transfixated.
I wonder
on this
if
chapter.
You picked the same one as me.
We'll find out. I think I was just so transfixed on this chapter just because I think, like, to me, it kind of really spoke to being in a room with a lot of intellectual people and, like, ultimately trying to show factual evidence of what's happening and just it falling on deaf ears, like, so publicly. I just, like, when I read it, it felt like something that just felt, that touched me in a different way. So the quote that I pulled out was in response to all the evidence that had been given by Ernest Everhart, like the ultimate final reaction from all of the intellectuals that were on the stage at the conference. They say, "This then is our answer. We have no words to waste on you. When you reach your vaunted strong hands for our palaces and purpled ease, we will show you what strength is. In roar of shell and shrapnel and in whine of machine guns will our answer be crouched. We will grind your revolutionists down under our heel and we shall walk upon your faces. The world is ours and we are its lords and ours it shall remain. As for the host of labor, it has been in the dirt since history began, and I read history, right? In the dirt it shall remain so long as I and mine and those that come after us have the power. Theirs is the word. It is the king of words, power, not God, not mammon, but power. Pour it over your tongue until it tingles with it, power." Chilling.
Yeah, that was that. Yeah. That was chilling. So disgusting.
I feel like a visceral reaction when I read that. I was just like, oh, like I was like almost crawling out of my skin. I think with just such intentional wording, with such direct delivery, so publicly, I feel like so rarely do we get the opportunity for someone to actually say that so directly out loud, mm-hmm. that actually seeing the words on the page kind of like flipped an internal switch to be like, oh, these people don't really care how they're coming across anymore at this mm-hmm. point. Like, we're past niceties at this point. We're truly on opposite ends of a battlefield now. Like, I win, you lose. This is how it's going to be forever. Mm-hmm. Get ready. Yikes.
Luckily, that is far too eloquent a speech for our current president.
Yeah. No worries. That's going to come out of the orange mouth.
Yuck.
The closest thing will be like, "You didn't thank me." But maybe just as bad.
Oh my God.
"You didn't thank me while I stomped all over your face."
Yes. Oh, you didn't thank me for stomping all over your face. Be nicer about it.
I have a short quote that I can't remember if it preceded or followed that exact passage, but this one was Everhart. "I know nothing that I may say can influence you," he said. "You have no souls to be influenced. You are spineless, flaccid things. You pompously call yourselves Republicans and Democrats. There is no Republican Party. There is no Democratic Party. There are no Republicans nor Democrats in this house." It's freaking me out.
Yeah, my ears are going out.
"You are lick spittlers and panderers, the creatures of the plutocracy. You talk verbosely in antiquated terminology of your love of liberty, and all the while you wear the scarlet livery of the Iron Heel." Ugh, you know, it's, my arms are just chicken skin. It's so disturbing because, you know, what's going on right now, a lot of people are wondering, what is the Democratic Party doing? Mm-hmm. What is the Republican Party doing? Everyone is just letting people die, mm-hmm. just letting people die. And it's letting people lose their lives, lose their funding, have no hope.
It's also literally killing people.
Literally killing people. So it taking away their access to medications and drugs and taking away their ability to care for their families, taking away their jobs.
Cruelty and impunity.
Exactly. So I think what hit me was like, there is no good side anymore.
Yeah. There's no soul to like to speak to, you know, if you don't stand for anything, like what is left for anyone to connect with? Yikes.
That line from Hamilton.
If you stand for nothing, Burr, what do you fall for?
Oh.
Oof. We can do another whole podcast on that someday.
I had a couple that I'm going to. Yeah. So the pitch for this book is that if you have not read it, go into it aware.
But read it.
That it is going to put into stark and clear words exactly what we are seeing right now. So while it was written over 100 years ago, it is giving voice to exactly where our country world is going right mm-hmm. now. So I got a couple that are, I think, less hair-raising, but still well-written, which is the point of this particular
yes.
segment. This is from page 24, and it's from a footnote. In those days, thievery was incredibly prevalent. Everybody stole property from everybody else. The lords of society stole legally or else legalized their stealing, while the poorer classes stole illegally. Nothing was safe and unless guarded. Enormous numbers of men were employed as watchmen to protect property. The houses of the well-to-do were a combination of safe deposit vault and fortress. The appropriation of the personal belongings of others by our own children of today... Belongings of others by our own children of today is looked upon as a rudimentary survival of the theft characteristic that in those early times was universal. Yes, we are legalizing theft in so many ways. And then another one from page 30. In the terrible wolf struggle of those centuries, no man was permanently safe, no matter how much wealth he amassed. Out of fear for the welfare of their families, men devised a scheme of insurance. To us, in this intelligent age,
what a scheme.
Such a device is laughably absurd and primitive. But in that age, insurance was a very serious matter. The amusing part of it is that the funds of the insurance companies were frequently plundered and wasted by the very officials who were entrusted with the management of them.
Oh, my God. That is so accurate.
Yes. And then just one earnest moment. Sometimes, this is early in the book as well, page 46, sometimes he exchanged the rapier for the club and went smashing amongst their thoughts right and left. And always he demanded facts and refused to discuss theories, and his facts made for them a Waterloo. When they attacked the working class, he always retorted, "The pot calling the kettle black, that is no answer to the charge that your own face is dirty." There were some really good written parts about the intellectual banter
mm-hmm.
that happened mm-hmm. in this book.
Good imagery on that one.
Yeah. Natalie, got a favorite?
I don't... you read... the passage that I like, I don't know, do any of you follow AOC on
yes.
Instagram? Like, it was, I was like, she's like almost there. Her and Bernie Sanders are almost there of like that type of speech
mm-hmm.
in Congress. But they are still both with the Democratic Party. And so mm-hmm. they're not there. And I'm just waiting for like, what is the tipping moment of when they stand up and have a bomb thrown at their feet and are called terrorists
yeah.
because it's this close.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of another passage, but I don't think so. If it comes up later,
yeah.
we can splice it back in, Zach.
I had one more.
Yeah.
And this one's beautifully written, but this was the one that incited my nightmare. So apologies to one and all.
Oh, I found one.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. I don't think that this is exactly where we are right now, but the fact that Jack London specifically pointed out Germany as the clash between mm-hmm. just foreshadowed, mm-hmm. you know, the
a
world
clash
wars,
that happened.
A clash that happened. But also, I think right now, I think it's maybe more let's replace Germany with Russia. Or China, yeah. It was this renewal of peace that brought about the alliance between Germany and the United States. In reality, this was an alliance between the emperor and the oligarchy
mm-hmm.
for the purpose of meeting their common foe, the revolutionary proletariat of both countries. And it was this alliance that the oligarchy afterward so treacherously broke when the German socialists rose and drove the warlord from his throne. It was the very thing the oligarchy had played for, the destruction of its great rival in the world market. With the German emperor on the way out, Germany would have no surplus to sell abroad, but the very nature of the socialist state, the German population would consume all it had produced. Of course, it would trade abroad certain things it produced for things it did not produce. This would be quite different from the unconsumable surplus. All of the stuff about economics like really freaked me out in this book about, because London had no idea where we were going to be today. Like he thought they were producing a lot.
Yep.
Like it's
nothing.
Thousands
nothing.
Fold.
Yeah.
Yeah. So much.
Yeah.
Whew.
Which my wife is very scared about that specific thing happening. Dear listener, my wife is in the military and does not very much like it right now.
I do not blame her. Ready for my nightmare passage, everyone? This is during the Chicago uprising. Mm. Swinging around the shattered walls of a building in the Stockyards district, the automobile was stopped by a wave of dead. It was for all the world like a wave tossed up by the sea. Wild. It was patent to us what had happened. As the mob charged past the corner, it had been swept at right angles and point-blank range by the machine guns drawn up on the cross street. But disaster had come to the soldiers. A chance bomb must have exploded among them, for the mob, checked until its dead and dying formed the wave, had white-capped and flung forward its foam of living, fighting slaves. Soldiers and slaves lay together, torn and mangled, around and over the wreckage of the automobiles and guns. It makes me sick. Just like the waves of people. It was a wave of dead bodies overcoming the automobiles and guns of the soldiers, not them victoriously overcoming the soldiers. Just there were too many dead bodies that they just smushed, like just suffocated them. That is the most fucked up thing I have literally ever read.
Picture like the scene in World War Z where that
picture the Russian Revolution where they tried to storm the palace and they were all trampled.
Yep.
Yeah. Like hundreds of people died in a matter of minutes.
Or it makes me even think of like current events, like remember the Astro World disaster where there was like that concert something happened and then like all of the people surged forward trapping other people and stuff. Mm-hmm. Like that's the image that I get is like people from the back coming forward almost creating a physical wave of people just falling on top of each other.
And it's fear. It's massive amounts of poor, dying, fearful people who have not been given any opportunity just
to get out of the way.
Yes, not they have no choice.
We walked through the night and made it back to Castle Rock a little past 5 o'clock on Sunday morning, the day before Labor Day. We'd only been gone 2 days, but somehow the town seemed different, smaller.
So in my fan humanoid moment, I have a quote that I think says,
yeah, we're right there. Let's do it.
It was now dynamic, a fascinating spectacle of dread. It surged past my vision in concrete waves of wrath, snarling and growling, carnivorous, drunk with whiskey from pillaged warehouses, drunk with hatred, drunk with lust for blood, men, women, and children in rags and tatters, dim, ferocious intelligences with all the godlike blotted from their features and all the fiendlike stamped in, apes and tigers, anemic consumptives, and great hairy beasts of burden, wan faces from which vampire society had sucked the juice of life, bloated forms swollen with physical grossness and corruption, withered hags and death's heads, bearded like patriarchs, festering youth with festering age, faces of fiends, crooked, twisted, misshapen monsters blasted with the ravages of disease and all the horrors of chronic innutrition, the refuse and the scum of life, a raging, screaming, screeching, demonical horde. And why not? The people of the abyss had nothing to lose but the misery and pain of living.
Oh.
Really hard I have that stuff
that as well. Yeah.
Hard to read.
It's so vivid, right? Mm-hmm. Like I think like the descriptors in this just really paint a picture in your brain. It's like these aren't even really people at this point. Mm-hmm. They are like life forms.
Yep. Animal, a lot of animal descriptors. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just a point of disfiguration.
Yeah. And animal, like animal descriptors, like wolf, snarling.
Yeah, well, dehumanizes them. And not in the negative, like, he's not doing it. It's a description attributed to Avis. She's narrating this, but I don't think it's intended in the way we intend to think about dehumanizing language.
Yes.
I don't think she's meaning that they're less than human. I think she's meaning that they've been reduced to something less than human by the circumstances in which they live.
Mm-hmm.
That's a subtle distinction, but I think it makes sense.
Yes. I agree.
Any other fan humanoid moments? I feel like that kind of blurs together with the word processor piece.
Did anyone find this parts about like Mexico and Canada and Cuba? There, so a lot of stuff in the news talks about like, let's turn Canada into the 51st state, you know, tariffs on Canada and Mexico and all this stuff. Well, there was a section that was interesting. It was and it was for the same reason that Canada was lost to the mother country. But Canada crushed her own socialist revolution, being aided in this by the Iron Heel. At the same time, the Iron Heel helped Mexico and Cuba to put down revolt. The result was that the Iron Heel was firmly established in the New World. It had welded into one compact political mass, the whole of North America, from the Panama Canal to the Arctic Ocean. And I just thought it was funny that and it's Iceland. Like brings up Panama Canal, Canada. Yeah. It's like, what is going on? Jack London, did you have
the Orange Monarch read this.
He was a wizard.
Well, maybe not him. Jack London was someone else who wrote Project 2025.
Bannon. And
Mm-hmm. I thought that was really, when I got to the end of that section, I was like, I've got to reread this again. Did he also mention the Panama Canal?
No.
What is going on?
Any of you all know what a sundown town is?
Yes, sir, we do.
Well, this is a sundown county. If I had found you pissing in my woods like animals after dark, it would have been my sworn duty to hang every single one of you from them trees.
It's not sundown yet.
So next phase of the game, I think we're ready to move on, is what the fiction, WTF. We have a few sections there. 404, page not found. Those are poorly written passages. Lost in space, that are things that are...
Lost in spice? That's very Dune of you.
No, that's a Skippy John Jones reference, sorry.
Oh.
Lost in space, things that are simply too far out to be believed. And then we have Lovecrapped, in honor to H.P. Lovecrapped. Cringy passages or things that would no longer be acceptable, and the asexual reproduction section. So anybody have some poorly written passages or things that are just way too hard to believe? This is where I found out in the book. This is what I put down, but there are no black people in the book. And I have that. Yeah. That
I think that was like cringy.
Yes, it's definitely cringy, poorly written, weird things we wouldn't write. I have a cringier one though.
I feel like... And this is unfortunate, but in the time that he was writing, it's not unbelievable. It's unbelievable now.
Right.
But in that specific time. And
this
time,
is things that we would not accept now.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like the abrupt ending.
Yes.
On my version, yes. It was just boop, and
I
this book is over.
I have crazy plot twists, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I also, like, as cool sci-fi-y as the plastic surgery was, I was like, yeah, no. They, like, had barely done surgery, so.
I just think it's so fascinating, like, right, we're talking about how old this manuscript is. 1908, like, really forecasting that plastic surgery would be something that came into fashion, right, that people would be able to somehow.
And I don't know when it started.
But he's depicting, like, 1912 to 1932. So, and he was in 1908. Did he really think that medical practices would advance that far?
Much in 10 or 15 years?
And it's almost he really respected doctors. Idea of like Frankensteining a person in a way that I think really lends itself to this kind of Iron Heel.
Well, and that would have been one of the only images, one of the only, you know,
that Shelley
piece of fiction. Yeah,
that involved some sort of melding together of human features.
And
that
is not a positive, but he might have jumped off of that.
No, I mean, it wouldn't make you a good spy. You would stick out like a sore thumb. Bolts on the side of your head. Jeez.
But it almost makes you think of, like, you know, disguising, right? Like, if someone's face becomes too recognizable or you need to make someone disappear, right? You could use medical enhancement in some way to either enhance or de-enhance a human, which I thought was really fascinating when we're thinking about the Iron Heel and consolidating power. There might be people you can make disappear very quickly by just erasing features.
I think another weird, I was just trying to think, a weird cringy passage, and this like kind of dovetails off of the plastic surgery, is Avis talks about how she never got plastic surgery, but rather just changed herself so much that she was unrecognizable. And
that scene was creepy.
It was really creepy, with her pretending to not be herself
and faking out
her own husband. And so I was wild. I the whole time it was being read to me, I was like, I know she's saying why this is important. Like, it was to prove to herself that she would be unrecognizable as mm-hmm. a person from the resistance if she could fool her own husband. But I was like, this man was just imprisoned for
like
2 years. And he's like, wait, who the F are you? Like, why? Where's my wife? Mm-hmm. And I think maybe goes back to what you were saying earlier about, like, the only thing that he had that he cared about then in that scene was being taken from him. Mm-hmm. And you could, like, see how fragile he was of, like, what's going on?
Where is she? Mm-hmm.
Where's Rachel?
No, I was like, she's going, what's that guy's name? The guy who goes and murders all the people who kidnap his daughter.
Liam Neeson.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where is she?
It's a specific set of skills.
Yeah.
So we're getting to the David Bowie Liam section. But that reminded me, David Bowie played John Merrick, the Elephant Man, on Broadway.
Did he?
Yes, and he did not do any makeup. He just contorted and distorted his body and his mannerisms to be John Merrick, who was, of course, horribly disfigured by his disease. Yeah. I don't know. So maybe it is possible.
Yeah.
If David Bowie can do it.
I think, it, like, I don't... David I don't, Bowie was a magician. I don't think it's impossible, right? But, like, you know, we look at people who have mental disorders.
Right.
Who can contort their face and demeanor to really look.
M. Night Shyamalan.
Right. But I think it was cringy, and I don't think it was necessary. I don't think it added any, like, maybe the part to, like, show his one weakness, but I'm like, you could have done that by him, like, when he sees her for the first time, like at the end when he saves her from Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
That was another moment in where it was like, he has some attachment here.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of, we're talking about this, kind of like gave me another thought. I feel like maybe Jack includes this, because for me, I feel like it speaks to Avis's ability to transform throughout the novel. Mm. Right. Like, mm-hmm. we can kind of see her clearly working through that sense of attachment that I feel like we talked about a little bit earlier in the podcast. Like, you know, I'm trying to aspire to be X type of person, mm-hmm. but I'm not ultimately at that level yet. I have to go through things to really be able to see the perspective, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Funny enough, I'm in a class that's focused on transformation. So I think that, like, this is kind of in my, just like my general brain right now, but I really feel like that section is her kind of being like, proving to herself in a way that, like, do I really understand? Am I, like, preaching what I'm actually attempting to do here? Mm-hmm. I agree that I think, like, for poor, like, her husband's sake, it's unfortunate that it has to go to such, like, a very serious and deep place. But I think maybe the reason for including is to kind of show the reader that she's going through this intentional mm-hmm. process of really testing herself, her ability to stand firm in her convictions, mm-hmm. and, like, how far is she really willing to go in order to see that reality come into existence. Mm-hmm. But yeah, still cringy to read.
Yeah, I think it showed her commitment to the revolution, her commitment to the, it was disturbing. Yeah. And I think that's why it was so well done, you know, because she went from being this pampered socialite daughter of a professor, you know, to living in a cave. You know, a cave house, and psychologically breaking herself so that she could mm-hmm. become someone else mm-hmm. to fight the Iron Heel.
It makes me think of disturbing. V for Vendetta, honestly, like when she's in the cell.
Oh my God.
That'd be another great.
Anyway, I want to watch that movie again.
You know, where she's in the cell, right? And ultimately, V's whole plot is to break her and make her concede. But she chooses not to until the final scene where he finally agrees to just let her go. So I just think I see a parallel there. I just think it's really fascinating. Yeah, mm-hmm. she broke herself in the process.
All right. Cringy time.
Ooh.
I had this whole weird, as the college professor at the table, no girl could live in a university town until she was 24 and not have love experiences. I had been made love to by beardless sophomores and gray professors and by the athletes and the football giants. But not one of them made love to me as Ernest did. Not been my experience on a college campus.
Yeah.
Just weird. Clearly, the world was a different place for women back in the
day. The definition for made love to was very different, I think, back then, though. I don't think it was...
Just made googly eyes.
I don't think it was necessarily implicitly sexual. I think it was sexual in nature, but it was more like petting, quote unquote, you know, heavy petting. My great grandmother used to use this phrase. So it was essentially what we would call making out. So
I think that's kind of what I
slightly less cringy, but not really.
Still not less cringy because it sounds like she was just a teenager being pawed at by a bunch of co-eds.
And older men.
Assaulted by
old professors and like beardless men.
I think she's honestly speaking to as a woman being in a circumstance with a bunch of male intellectuals and the only one of the only females, the daughter of a professor. She got a lot of attention.
She sure did.
Mm-hmm. Like a lot of people doting on her, wanting to, you know, be in a relationship with her, et cetera.
Well, and then even at the, you know, at the very beginning of the book, she touches on, and I mean, this comes up again with the Red Virgin, but she's like, no one wanted to talk to me about this, and it wasn't just because of the topic I was pulling up. It was because she was a socialite woman, and that's not appropriate for you to talk about because you're not allowed to go to college. You're not allowed to be smart. You're just supposed to...
Decorate
the room. Yeah.
Literally
also,
and figuratively.
Your dad has a bunch of money, so
just go, you know, shouldn't spend, be like, worried.
You shouldn't be worried.
Just well, spend and like his
even
money.
Even at the beginning of the I think that this maybe was cringy for me as well. Like the fact that at the beginning, like I think it's hard because she's writing from her self older perspective. But realizing that at the very beginning, like when she first meets Ernest, she's like 17 and I'm pretty sure he's like 35. And I'm like, that is yuck.
Illegal.
Les problem.
Full disclosure, definitely illegal.
Yeah.
But that she's like so infatuated with him that it feels like she would do anything to be with him. And like I think the tables kind of turn, right? Like where he's like, I love you so much, I'll do anything. And going back to the cringy part of her changing herself, she's like, I can actually live without you. I've been doing it. I was imprisoned. You were imprisoned, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But just like, yeah, you hadn't been touched like that because you're 17.
Really good point.
Yeah.
As it should be.
Yeah.
So my mine was, I called this section, I have it in all caps in yellow highlight, female sublimation. Weird control / narcissism, more barf, 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 more barf. Okay, those are literally my notes.
That was not a direct quote.
Those are not quotes. Those are my subtitles for my quotes. So I said, there was no time for sex in this book. But the relationship between Avis and Ernest was entirely cringy. So I felt like it was all about female sublimation, especially for her in the beginning of her relationship with him. You know, these are all quotes from her. And yet he found time in which to love me and make me happy. But this was accomplished only through my merging my life completely into his. Mm-hmm. Sad. So this is Ernest talking to her about coming to the
Philomaths?
Yes. He's like, this is going to be terrible, but it's going to be good for you. Sad though this night's happening will be, I feel that it will draw you more closer to me. You're going to get traumatized, but I think you'll need me more and realize how awesome I am.
Big arms.
Yeah, more barf. He became my oracle. Yeah. If I ever say that about a man, please just
you said
hit
that
me over the head and give me meds. Take me to the hospital, okay? I felt humble and contrite and was aware of a sweet feeling that Ernest was a sort of father confessor. Then as ever...
Two things you shouldn't sleep with.
Right? Father confessor worse. Then, as ever after, his strength appealed to me. It seemed to radiate a promise of peace and protection.
Well, so like off that last line, and I think this is what made it so cringy for me, is basically she thinks he's hot at the dinner.
Oh yeah.
Someone needs to 100.
She's like, he's hot, but his coat's tight. She hits the nail right on the head when she's like, but he's full of himself.
Yes.
Like, yes. He's hot, but like, I don't like, he's a little bit too overconfident.
He's cocky.
And she says, oh boy, double entendre. She says she doesn't like it, but she obviously does.
Well, but I think the part that's cringy for me is he can tell that she has a crush on him. And he's like, I'll only be with you if you
completely devote your life to me.
So in order for me to even pay attention to you, not that it's bad, but like you have to read these books. You have to go talk to this guy. You have to become traumatized.
You have to come to my world.
Right. Yeah.
You have to go talk to this lawyer and figure out how effed up this situation is. Mm-hmm. And when you're all fucked up in the head, then come back to me and
I'll be ready to help you then.
Be my lady slave.
Which, like, I think
he's grooming her.
In a weird way. I think when right at the beginning she's like, I was really glad that he told me this stuff, kind of like the bishop. He's like, I'm not mad that I'm in this situation. I'm actually super grateful. But, like, you're also missing the mark, bro.
Yeah.
You didn't sell all your possessions and are helping the poor. Talk about cringy moments. Where is that when Ernest is like, I don't – charity is beneath me because we shouldn't even need charity.
I remember that.
So I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
Huh?
So gross.
It's beneath you?
Yeah.
Code for you don't have money for charity.
Yeah.
Hey, that would be fair.
Yeah.
Or you do, you just don't think, you just don't want to spend your money that way.
Yeah. Ooh. Cringed out.
There was no sex in this book, though. There is no sexual nor asexual reproduction. There was talk of sexual activity, but nothing happened. Unlike many of the other books we've read, that were some of the most bizarre sex scenes ever.
But they talked about how she didn't have sex.
Right.
Right. And purposefully turned men away.
It was a bit of a puritanical book.
Did Jack London ever write a sex scene? Someone ask ChatGPT quick.
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger. No, Will Robinson. Danger.
We're all
intruder dying. Alert. Strange and crazy plot twists. I have one.
Go for it.
Okay. It's more of a hypothesis twist. This book really happened. And we have been living it for the last 100 years.
Mm-hmm. I would say yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And here's the quote. Love of the right, desire for the right, unhappiness with anything less than the right. In short, right conduct is the prime factor of religion, and so with the oligarchy. Prisons, prisons, banishment and degradation, honors in palaces and wonder cities are all incidental. The great driving force of the oligarchs is the belief that they are doing right. Never mind the exceptions and never mind the oppression and injustice in which the Iron Heel was conceived. All is granted. The point is that the strength of the oligarchy today lies in its satisfied conception of its own righteousness. We are living it right now.
Yep.
It happened.
It's happening.
And it's happening.
Present,
and we're in it.
Present
and we
continuous.
Didn't even realize that the oligarchy won. And this is just the next little bump up that we're conquering right
this
now.
This is revolution number.
This is just the oligarchs further strengthening the grip they've had since, the time he wrote this book.
Mm-hmm. We need to devote more of our department budget to donuts if this is the case. We just need some more joy.
I honestly feel like one of the big things is I feel like this book is showing us that history repeats itself. That's why there's the abrupt ending.
I think it's all one continuous.
That's why it starts over.
There's a
cycle.
That's
why it takes 700 years.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, I really feel like this, unfortunately, is a book about the cyclical nature of humanity that we fortunately really don't learn from our mistakes.
Yeah, there's a couple more, right? A week later, the post office department ruled that the paper was seditious and it barred it entirely from the mails. That was a fearful blow to the socialist propaganda. And yet they were more fortunate than the Grangers, who captured a dozen state governments and who in the spring were not permitted to take possession of the captured offices. The incumbents refused to retire, and the courts were in the hands of the oligarchy. We are right there.
I wrote that. That was one of the Grangers were powerless. Yeah, I wrote that. I was like, the politicians not accepting the results of a fair election? ?
Yep. And just refusing to leave office. And if we haven't been there already, we're going to be there in
very soon.
Real soon.
I thought it'd be interesting to kind of look and see what the notebook pulled, because we did write about oligarchy, historical parallels. You know, the rise of the oligarchy, it talks about economic control, class conflict, labor struggles.
It's all in this book.
How to use force and violence, class conflict, propaganda, manipulation, the inevitability of the revolution, the nature of the oligarchy, totality of control, right? So I just think it's really fascinating. We see so many of these historical parallels.
Did we determine whether or not Jack London had ever written a sex scene?
Okay, so this is what ChatGPT says. Do you want?
Yes.
It's a ChatGPT answer.
Let's use AI to our advantage here.
Hallucinate a sex scene.
Because the notebook's going so well.
Yes, Jack London did write scenes with sexual content, although they are not as explicit by modern standards. His work often explores themes of survival, animal instincts, and human nature, and some of his stories include sexual elements as part of the larger narrative, which I think is probably. For example, in his novel, The Call of the Wild, there is a scene where Buck the dog is shown mating with a female dog in the wild, reflecting
the
primal instincts of the characters. Additionally, in The She-Wolf, London explores London's exploration of human relationships includes more complex dynamics, and while the book doesn't feature explicit sex scenes, moments of tension and attraction between characters that hint at deeper, more intimate emotions.
So he only wrote animals sex.
Right. Yes. So he was more, he didn't do the full romantic-y a la, you know.
Yeah. Well, Orwell has.
Yeah. The Iron Wing,
so
but
the
just subtle. Which, more, he's more on the Jane Austen side of the spectrum.
Yes. Yeah. The big arms are a big deal. Mm-hmm. This ChatGPT likes to say, you know, they don't feature sex scenes in a way that contemporary literature might.
Yeah. Fair.
Let's go back and write that chapter. Oh, his arms were so big. And when we got back from Congress, oh, how he made love to me.
And then he told you, am I your oracle?
Yeah,
very that.
I am your oracle. That wasn't a question.
We watched as the bombs shattered the second comet into a million pieces of ice and rock that burned harmlessly in our atmosphere and lit up the sky for an hour.
God.
All right, Deep Impact.
Okay, Bowie.
I got a bunch. This book spawned much of the dystopian literature we have. So the straight line is from this to Yevgeny Zamyatin's We, 1924 Russian dystopian novel, which influenced Orwell, which of course is next. Same themes as The Iron Heel. Orwell, of course, obvious. Orwell read this, commented on it, knows about it, knew about it. And then Aldous Huxley's Brave New World.
Oh, yeah.
He's also a child of this novel.
I see that a lot of parallels.
Philip K. Dick, Margaret Atwood, and others are directly in line with this, mirroring his themes of surveillance, oligarchic rule, and the struggle against totalitarianism. Of course, the Marxist thought that would come very soon. Trotsky praised the novel, noting how London accurately depicted the mechanisms of class struggle and the resilience of the ruling elite. Jack London was one of the Western authors who were officially published in the Soviet Union. Iron Heel is an accepted critique of capitalism.
Wow.
Mao Zedong reportedly loved Jack London's works, including The Iron Heel.
Oh my God.
He, of course, predicted fascism and authoritarianism. London's oligarchic rulers suppressed social uprisings. Same real-life Nazis and Franco's Spain. So just
lesser-known sci-fi novel except for famous dictators. Wow, we're good at picking books. That's freaky.
Yeah. So it has formed kind of the seed of where we have gone from there. Really fascinating that we hadn't read it, heard it, known about it.
I wonder how Jack feels knowing that so many people...
He feels dead.
Well, sure. But, like, I wonder if we were to talk to Jack today.
Very
how he would feel about inspiring.
Well, I can tell you how
probably
he feels.
Where are the royalties to my book? I live like and died in poverty.
I would like to die again, please. I don't want to be in this orange hell. Thanks.
God.
So, where's Bowie? This is, of
Donde
course,
está Bowie?
My favorite section. And my notes just went poof.
Don't you have these memorized or tattooed on your heart?
Well, there was a lot.
The Halloween Jack is a real cool cat, and he lives on top of Manhattan Chase. The elevator's broke, so he slides down the road onto the street view. All toss it, all man.
Where's Bowie? My favorite section as the gigantic David Bowie fan. Well, hard to say that there was a direct impact because one died. There was never contact. One died 20 years before the other one was born.
Mm-hmm.
So 30 years before the other one was born, I think. So they never met. However, well, they might have met in a sci-fi way. London was the primary influence of Orwell, as we already stated, and Bowie was absolutely obsessed with Orwell.
Mm-hmm.
So the album Diamond Dogs is an aborted rock opera of 1984 because Bowie could not get Orwell's widow to grant him the rights to do an actual rock opera of 1984. The main character, you all know Bowie switched characters over the course of his career.
Mm-hmm.
The main character in the album 1984 is Halloween Jack, who lives on top of Manhattan Chase and slides down a rope into the chaos below. And that character features most prominently in the Rebel Rebel music video. And, of course, the lyrics to that are, Rebel Rebel, you've torn your dress. Rebel Rebel, your face is a mess. Rebel Rebel, how could they know? Which sounds a whole lot like Avis in the Chicago commune uprising. So I think there could definitely be some there. The themes, post-apocalyptic, Bowie was always about post-apocalyptic everything. So I think there's a pretty clear influence there. Bowie loved Jack Kerouac. Was also influenced by Jack London, so there's a ton of relatively indirect. And then when I asked ChatGPT about connections, it basically said, well, if you were to imagine a scenario, Bowie travels back in time and meets Jack London, and the two of them together go on tour, basically. It was kind of funny, but I will say that Jack London spent a lot of time before he wrote this book in London, East Side of London, which was decimated. It was kind of a hellscape apparently at that point, and he did a lot of research hanging out with people of the abyss, if you will. Bowie was born in 47, grew up in London as well, in Brixton, not East London, but close enough, and that was decimated by post-World War II. So he was basically playing in the rubble of bombed out buildings. So there's this very clear Jack London was there.
Environmental connection, yeah.
Kind of, yeah.
Formative times.
Yeah, and they were both in and amongst that. So
I'll take
interesting.
It. Yeah. I'll take it.
All right, pew-pew time. This is when we rate the book on a scale of 1 to 5, which would be 1 to 10 pew-pew noises. So 1 pew would be a half. A pew-pew is a 1. A pew-pew-pew is a 1.5. Pew-pew-pew-pew is a 2. Just for clarity. So who would like to be
just for clarity?
With their pew 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 rating.
I rated mine as 5+ pew pews.
Wow.
I'm not gonna say all of them because that I think our producer might throw
pew 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 pew.
Thank you for
so
your service.
10 pew noises.
Yes. Because
this pew noise goes
this
to
book
11.
Haunted me.
Mm,
it was beautifully written and haunting. And I think I rate a book based on how long am I thinking about it?
The impact
when I read it. Am I thinking about it during the reading while I'm not reading it? You know, things like that. And am I thinking about it after and relating other things that I do see, think, hear, feel to contact in this book? So, yes, I think I said 5+ for traumatizing me with a sense of constant foreboding and realism was my response. But this
life
was
sucks.
This is a truly impactful book for me. So,
wow.
Yeah.
I can go next. I gave this book pew, 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 pew. I gave it a four. Or four pew pews.
Yes, four pew pews.
Eight noises.
I feel like, but similar. I think I was transformed after reading it. I could not see things that I see now in the world the same way now that I've read this book.
As books should do.
And, you know, I know I talked a little bit about how I've been in a class where we're really focused on this concept around transformation. It really is one of the only ways that you can actually really bind people and help elevate consciousness at the same time. I feel like this book does a really good job of that. It, like, for me, it helped, like, clarify and create language that I could understand for phenomenons I was seeing.
It was it's very, very clearly articulated.
Yes.
And so for me, I feel like it was like a in a weird way, a helpful guide to my current reality.
Heartwarming guide like to 2025.
I felt like I had language to describe things that I was seeing in front of me in a new way. Mm-hmm. And also in some ways a reminder that we're not alone on this journey. It's been, this book has been read for generations, right?
Years,
and so yeah. Other people have also been transformed by this work, maybe in some way or another.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also really hard to read. So I think that's the only thing that's impacting my score was just like how much I felt like I really had to slog and like sit with the language for it to fully wash over me to be able to get to that space where I felt like, wow, this is really important work, and I feel like I've been transformed through the process of reading it.
Mm-hmm.
Shall I go? I'm going to give it seven noises. Pew, 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 which equates to a 3.5. The thing Britt said resonates with me, both of you. It is impactful. It's accurate. And the thing about fiction, there's been plenty of studies out that the reading of fiction activates the same things in your brain as having those experiences. Yeah. Your brain can't tell the difference between reading it and experiencing it. So hugely impactful.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I needed more of that impact right now.
Right.
In the way we're living. Hugely impactful. Yeah. I just despise the ending. Like
I didn't like the ending
it,
either.
It ended so fast, so abruptly, and no one ever heard from Avis again. Bye. I want to know, you got 700 more years. Where's the rest of the story? What happened? Where are
lost
we
lost in the tree stump or whatever.
I asked ChatGPT to rewrite an ending for me. That was unsatisfactory. It would have been probably the 10 noise plus had it actually ended instead of just
Fair point.
Mm-hmm. I'll probably give it four pew pews. Pew 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 pew.
That's an eight.
Yeah.
Eight noises.
Eight noises.
Oh, four. I thought you meant four out of five. I thought you meant pew 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 pew.
This
I was
this
like,
scale is terrible.
Two?
No, four pew pews.
I don't even understand
four out of five.
My own
it's an
scale.
80%. It's 80%.
I was here for the making of the scale and I'm lost.
I think, like you were saying, Claire, just it clarified a lot of things. It wasn't the nicest book to read right at this moment because typically, you know, with a lot of the other books that Justin has introduced me to through this podcast, it's been a way to kind of escape. Like maybe there were some parallels of like, oh yeah, okay, I can see the peripheral happening, but it's not happening.
Oh,
the
jackpot is happening right
well,
now.
Well, I mean, the jackpot is happening, but like, the jackpot isn't the main, like, it's not so forefront in the book, right? So, so it was, but like I, like you said, it adds a little bit. I think I didn't mind the ending so much, but I feel like endings that are cut off because I have such an imagination of like already at the beginning of the book, I was like, this is the precursor to X book in my mind, that even though she was cut off, I was like, the story continues. I know what happens after.
Because it tells us like, this is what happened after this. We found this manuscript in a tree trunk. She wrote this not even realizing that their, you know, revolution was about to fail. So we kind of, it ended abruptly, but yeah, we knew the narrative that would follow.
Yeah. But maybe, I think like the biggest thing for me is that
some of the writing was maybe boring to me at times, mm-hmm. But I think it was super eloquent, and so I was able to be like, okay, this is what's happening in my life. I'm not insane.
Eight.
I think this might be the highest ranked book.
Plus another seven. So 33 and a half divided by four.
Mm.
I'm trying to come up with
an average. I'm wondering, I read a lot of books from the mid 1800s to the early 1900s as a genre, like not a genre, but I like reading. I didn't find the writing boring.
There was just some times where I was like, oh, I can't continue. Because, okay, again, I'm listening to this, right?
Ah, yes. That is also different.
Right, it's different.
I was reading it, yeah.
Yeah, so I was like, I can't, yeah. Like,
but the narrative didn't have a lot of, it wasn't like, there were parts of it that were very energized and moving quickly, but a lot of it was very narrative and exploratory.
Yeah, there were just like some points where I was like. Freaking
4-page footnotes every.
Yes. Yeah. Very long.
Yeah.
But that style of writing is very, and it's just Jane Austen, you know, just exploratory narratives, asides that are very long, you know. So I'm like, ooh.
I know I wasn't featured on the last podcast because I ended up not being able to.
Charlotte Perkins Gilman. It's a keeper.
Herland. Yeah. No, I read it and I thought it was boring.
Ooh, that's Britt's favorite book ever.
Spicy.
So total 8.375.
You're fired.
But I think it was for a lot of the same reason as like I was just like
the narrative.
When is something going to happen? Like there were like very few moments for, where it was like, okay, and then we were jailed, and I was like, okay, and now let's do three chapters. Of
what
the
jail cell looks like.
Right.
And it was the like, bars oh my are God. So iron. Yeah. And so heavy.
The reason why it was the most chill jailing ever is because they were educating them, feeding them, and giving them nice clothes the whole time. They were protected from themselves.
Also, as someone who like probably skims footnotes typically, this is something that you absolutely needed to be reading the footnotes for, and they gave so much context.
Most of them. Except the one that said, why?
I kind of love that.
Food. I thought that was funny with the grub.
Yeah.
Food.
Don't footnote things I know, please.
Oh, I love it.
So this was a 4.2 out of 5. Our highest
That's
rated
high.
Book wow. so far.
Yeah.
Good job.
That's great.
Jack London.
Good job.
You're rich in our minds.
Good job, Google, for suggesting it when I Googled
So our
books
next
to read.
Book is The Worm Ouroboros. A Romance by Eric Rucker Edison, 1922. My digging into this book a little bit, it's a precursor to all of the high fantasy inspired Tolkien, based on Norse mythology. So it should be interesting. We need something a little bit, hopefully, lighter.
I did find out when I was looking for this audiobook that there is also a band
called The Worm Ouroboros.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
We've got some cultural impact right there.
We might
there.
Need some music listening. Yeah.
So The Worm Ouroboros tells the story of the conflicts and alliances between the kingdoms of Demonland and Witchland. Not super creative.
I'm
name,
into it.
Involving characters such as Lord Jus, not Justin, just Jus, Lord Brandoch Daha, and Queen Prismer.
It's not a fantasy book unless there's some funky names you can't pronounce.
The plot includes battles, quests, and political schemes driven by magical elements like conjuring and charms. Journeys to lands such as Impland and Kostra Bellorn. And quests for items like the Hippogriff's Egg propel the narratives. Ultimately, the story explores themes of ambition, fate, loyalty, and the cyclical nature of conflict symbolized by the worm Ouroboros himself.
I'm ready for some escapism romanticism.
We
Bring
will
it on.
Escape the hell out of this shit next time. Thank you all for listening. Thanks, participants.
And feel free to go meditate and
like
us and follow and subscribe. Us on all of the popular podcast platforms.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. And thanks to Zach.
Woo!
In the basement where the nerds reside. We gather round with a wicked stride, with our books in hand. We start to die. into dystopian worlds.